Welcome to Uncle Nene's Nerdcast. I'm your host, Nathan Fletcher, a.k.a. Uncle Nene. I am very happy to have our guest today. It's going to be a fun show for filmmakers, for people who love sci-fi movies, people who want to know what it's like to own your own management production company, all that stuff. It is really going to be an incredible story. Welcome to the show, Dan DiFilippo.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here, Dan. It's going to be a fun show. I grew up in the production business. Started working for a production company when I was 16. So I love production. And so this is going to be fun. As you know, you're a producer and a filmmaker. It'll be a lot of fun. Most people in the sci-fi world kind of know you from Shockwave, Darkseid, an independent project, and we're going to get into the details of that later. Sure. But I first wanted to start off just, were you a big sci-fi fantasy fan when you were a kid, or was there anything that kind of grabbed you? Were you a Star Trek, Star Wars, anything in that vein that grabbed you when you were a kid that got you into doing sci-fi?
Yeah, I was a big Star Wars guy. You know, as a kid, like collected all the toys and all that stuff. I wish I still had them, but I came home from college and my mom was like, I think those things are worth a lot of money now. And so, you know, I basically sold it all for beer money. But yeah, Star Wars is the one for me. And then, of course, you know, during that time period, like when Empire came out and whatnot, we also had like the Indiana Jones thing going on, Goonies, and, you know, just these movies that took you out of your space of reality. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Very similar in my development as well. So that's great. One of the things I think is really interesting is, you know, you started, in your early career in the store department at Fireworks Pictures, and worked on the big budget move, Wind Talkers. What did you take from those early days? Any kind of lessons you learned or stories you can share?
Yeah. I mean, Fireworks was great because it was the story department. So it was all about writing and, you know, analyzing scripts and discussing, would this work for what we're looking for with the, you know, the internal producers and such. But I mean, honestly, what I learned from Wind Talkers was do not spend $115 million on a movie, you know?
That's great.
I said to my two bosses, the producers of the project, and one of their husbands actually wrote the movie as well. Okay. So they made out like bandits regardless, you know?
Yeah.
But I was like, we could have made 10, $15 million movies for this budget, you know?
Yeah.
And that was a little insult to injury because it was after the movie opened where it only made like $17 million opening weekend, you know?
Yeah.
And it just clicked to me that like this math doesn't work when it doesn't work in a big way, you know?
Yeah. I would imagine that may have gotten reinforced for you when you started to work at William Morris. I understand you worked both in New York and LA.
Yeah.
Seeing the agency side of the business up close and personal, did that maybe reinforce your kind of indie filmmaker core?
It did, because there are a lot of politics in those places, you know? And I mean, I used to deal with the biggest filmmakers in the business. Like I worked for the agent who represented Tarantino and the guys from South Park, and, you know, Gus Van Sant was on the phone every day. You know what I mean? So I would talk with these people and they had the same take, you know, how hard it is to like do things in the traditional studio way, because of all the politics and because of all the different hoops you have to jump into. And then, you know, I'm sitting in LA and, you know, surfing and hanging out and working for these crazy people, you know. And that's when the tax incentives were initiated in New York. And I'm from New York. And I said, there's going to be a renaissance of film in New York, you know. So I used the agency to transfer to our New York office, the William Morris New York office, and started figuring out how to get into that, you know, to leave the big agency, big studio, big picture world to make stuff the way I wanted to make it, you know?
That's great. At
price points where you could actually make money, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Phenomenal. You know, was there, I think of, you know, I grew up starting in video production. And so we shot on like 3/4 inch SP, and then we upgraded to beta, and it was a big deal. And then digi beta, but we always wanted to, and then we started working on like shooting with 16 millimeter film. And then, you know, the big daddy super 35 millimeter. And I remember the first project that it was a music video. We shot on 35 millimeter film. And I felt like I was a young kid in my early 20s. And I felt like, oh, I made it. I'm shooting on film like a real grown up. Did you ever have one of those moments, you know, as you were starting off where you're like, felt like, oh my God, this is a new phase for me, or this is, you know, this is something I've been hoping to do. And I'm finally here.
Not in particular, because it's particularly in LA, it's just all around you all the time, every second of every day, you know?
Yeah.
So it becomes a norm very quickly.
Yeah, very different when you're trying to do production in Texas. It's a different world. Shooting on film is not the norm.
Right.
When you're starting, yeah.
But even now, it's like everything's digital. And for the death and life of John F. Donovan, that was shot on 35 and 75 film.
Wow.
So I produced the New York leg of that. That involved aerials with helicopters and such. And just finding those cameras now.
Yeah. There's like
7 of them in the country, you know,
wow.
Particularly for 75. And so it became more of not like an aha moment, more like a, how the hell do we do this moment? You know what I mean?
Right.
And then there are no film labs left on the East Coast to process that. So
yeah,
like that footage had to exist in my offices up in Times Square for like 2 days before we could send somebody with all of it, literally carrying it, because it's precious now, you know?
Yeah.
It was somewhere in, I think it was North Carolina or something.
Yeah.
Where there was an actual lab, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. One of my second job was in Corpus Christi, Texas, working for the family of Selena. Oh, I don't know if you're familiar with the Spanish singer Selena that got killed. And yeah, so her family.
I've served Corpus Christi.
Oh, okay. All right, great. So I lived down there working for her family, and we did, you know, videos, TV shows, and we would shoot all the music videos in on film. Mm-hmm. And so it was a big part of the process for us was, you know, I would fly the film up to Dallas because that was the nearest processing and transfer place. And then, you know, we'd sit in the room and, you know, color it all day. And it was like a whole thing. And then, you know,
the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a whole thing. And, you know, I tell, when I talk to younger folks who are familiar with, you know, the digital world only about that whole process, they're just blown away. They can't even imagine, you know, you had to really trust your DP back then, because you had no idea what you were getting. You had no idea what you were getting in the field. Exactly. You were just having it on faith, you know. And people today, they expect to be able to see exactly what they're going to get and on location, and so it's fascinating to see that kind of transition.
Well, even like the edit, you know, it's called cutting because you used to use razor blades,
right?
You know, and
right.
Splice frames together. Yeah.
Incredible.
Which is like would blow a young kid's mind today.
Yeah. Even after that, but before digital, when you were editing tape to tape, you had a switcher and you edited linearly. You started at the beginning of the project and you went to the end, and that's how you edited. So you really had to have, I think, the one benefit to it, you know, the drawbacks were when you needed to change, but the benefit to it was you had to have a vision. you had to have a vision. You had to know
prior
how you wanted it to go. You know, there was not just, well, let me just try a bunch of different stuff. It was like, no, this is how we're going to put this together.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. You know, storyboards come into play there.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
Rethinking, which is
one of the things it did for me is because I really was drawn into editing and I started editing a lot is, you know, we'd edit the audio first and then you'd go back and you'd put the video onto it a lot of times. And so it started making me think along the lines of where are all the pieces where someone's going to talk or I'm going to have some audio to, I've got to do that first. And so you really would have that kind of think of building something linear like that, you know?
That's interesting. So you backed into it.
Right.
Yeah, into the image.
Right. You'd be like, okay, this is all B-roll. I'll ignore this. I'm going to go back and paste the B-roll on top, but what are all the audio components that have to happen first?
Interesting. And,
yeah. I think it helped me as a producer because I would start to think about, okay, where's all the sound on tape? Where are all the talking parts? You know, and you start to think about that. But
right, yeah.
So let's get into Shockwave Dark Side. I think it's fascinating. For anybody who hasn't seen it, it's a 2014 very ambitious independent sci-fi film. I'm going to play the trailer just for anyone who hasn't seen it. So it's about a minute 45.
Oh, cool. So I haven't seen that in forever.
God was outlawed while the earth burned. All that is left of humanity are two warring tribes. We, the banished, were exiled to the moon after the water jihad. And now, they are coming here for the unpoisoned water of our ice, buried in the craters, deep beneath our cities and domes.
Status report. They keep fuzzing the radar. I can't get a lock on anything.
All I know is that we all keep fighting over the same thing. Holes in the ground with inches of water in them. This war is getting meaner.
This place is not safe. The rescue point is our best option.
That's an awful lot of territory to cover. Unmapped. You sure we got enough air?
No one ever got saved by standing still, John. We need to fall back. Go! Go, go, go! I'm reading that we're not on lunar soil at all.
You have sold out everything you ever believed in. For what?
Don't you see? Both sides are gonna need us alive. Because this could end the war.
So does that take you back?
Takes me back to a freezing sandpit in New England.
Oh, wow. Well, I want to hear about that. Tell me about first, though, how did you get into that? How did you get drawn into doing that project? How did it come about?
So when I got back from L.A. to New York, I started something with a bunch of guys called the Evil City Film Festival, the East Village City Film Festival.
Okay.
And so we, the first year we, you know, screened all these movies like in like back bar screening rooms and had this whole thing and people loved it. It was great. It was kind of like rock and roll meets film, you know?
Great.
I met this director who, we screened his short film that was done really well, actually. It was like a World War II kind of like period piece. And so, you know, we got to talking and he gave me this script and I dug it, you know? So got together with him, you know, went over the script a few times, notes, notes, notes. And then, you know, I packaged it, found financing. And we did, you know, everything cast, you know, when I come on to produce something, it's like beginning to end kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's wild, you know, like Sonequa is like the captain of the Starship Enterprise now, you know. May, who's in the film, was Psylocke in X-Men 3.
Yeah.
Bill Sage was great. Everybody knows Bill. Rich, he's in everything now, you know. So
yeah,
it's kind of like a really cool cast of characters that we got to work with. And they've all, you know, gone on to do like really big things.
I found that really neat. You know? That's got to be a really neat thing to see. You know, can you, and you, it's okay if you can't answer this, but can you answer what the budget was?
Oh, we made that movie for less than $1 million.
Okay. Wow.
In 3D.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible. So you talked about a New England sand pit. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I was up in like on the Cape. So we needed a location that looked like the moon, you know?
Yeah.
We're like, garbage dump sand pit looks like the moon. You know?
That's great.
That's so great. Like minimal lights. Like from a production standpoint, it was very hard, but also from a production standpoint, it's like because we were shooting in 3D, there was a lot of it was almost like shooting a play, you know.
Right.
And it's the moon, so there's not a lot of like crazy lighting going on.
Yeah,
I think we had like three lights for the entire shoot, you know.
I'm curious, you know, all the graphics, you know, was that something that was real costly for you, a big chunk of the budget, or no?
No, I found these guys out in Minnesota, and I've actually used them on like 6 different movies to date.
Fantastic.
And, you know, they live in Minnesota, so it's like they're not living the cost of living in New York or LA,
right.
Or, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
They just love working on this stuff because it's coming from New York and it's coming from LA, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, the effects, which by the way, look so much better in 3D because they were created for 3D.
Oh, right.
So
right.
Like, go to the 2D version, which is, what most people see. It always kills me. I'm like, oh, like even that opening shot with the lunar base, right? When those cannons are firing towards us, right? And explode here and here, like it all in 3D. It's like you're getting attacked, you know?
Right.
Everything just floats around you. It's like extraordinary.
And then you kind of get flattened when it goes to 2D.
It's flattened in the 2D, yeah. Which is a bummer, but you know, now I own a 3D television, so that's cool.
One of the perks.
It was the only way to watch cuts.
So 10 years later, how have you know, thinking about how the industry has changed.
Oh my god.
From when you produced that. You know, just, you know, what's kind of jumps out at you is like one of the most transformative aspects to filmmaking that you didn't see coming.
Strikes. The actor's strike, the writer's strike, when IATSE almost striked, you know, it's crazy. The last like 2.5-3 years, the industry has impaled itself on a strike blade, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's only starting to recover now, and it's really so many people are struggling because of those strikes, you know. It's like
it was a 1-2 punch between the strikes and COVID. I felt like it's going to take some time, and then I always, you know, what are your thoughts on, I worry about, is the younger generation going to have the love of the movies that maybe you and I did, or are they so consumed by social video? They don't care.
I think if we make really good movies, they will, you know,
right.
How That's do you what not love E.T.? You know what I mean?
Right.
Right. But like another, I don't know, man. I know people love them. They make a lot of money, but like, I don't need to see another superhero movie, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm just not, I don't know. I'd rather see like an E.T. kind of movie, or I'm not saying go back to like doing Westerns, you know,
yeah.
But like good cinema is good cinema.
Yeah.
I mean, we're working right now on the sequel to the Dementia 13 movie I did for Universal. Just finished the script, fished it out, bringing actors back. And it's so layered and cool, you know, like it's kind of has like a, what did somebody say after reading it? They were like, this reminded me of watching Silence of the Lambs, like that
kind
of
great
psychological, good movie, you know?
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that because you did, of course, Dementia 13 is kind of classic Coppola horror. Then there's Catskill Park, which is creature feature. How does that, you know, producing horror fantasy, you know, compare to sci-fi? Is there a difference in your mind, or is it not really matter, more just story? You know, I'm curious, you know, from your perspective, how it differs.
I mean, for me, producing is with anything really, we try to focus on story first and then, you know, go and find the money, right?
Yeah.
And then once you're, you know, for example, like Dementia 13, right? The studio is like, we know you're not going to be able to shoot this at a castle. And I'm like, oh, I'm shooting it at a castle, you know? So now we went and looked at like 100 castles on the East Coast, you know?
Wow.
Couldn't find one that would like fit into the budget, fit into the schedule, fit in, blah, blah, blah. We're coming home from Singer Castle up in the island region, you know, up by Canada, basically.
Oh, really?
One of my assistants, I'm like, why don't we find somebody who's trying to sell their castle?
Ah, yeah. Good.
Right? You know?
Yeah. That's
She's
good.
Like, that's a good idea. By the time we got back to New York City, we had one. The castle we ended up shooting in, it's got Buddy Fletcher, some like huge Wall Street guy, you know, left that castle in the middle of the night for some reason. Like his slippers, when we went, were still next to the bed. Totally creepy. You know, like cans of, he hadn't been there for like 5 years, like cans of food still in the kitchen.
Wow.
They like left in a hurry via helicopter.
Wow.
I don't know why, but you know, but, you know, so after we found that location, now it's like dealing with the town, dealing with this, dealing with that, you know, but always trying to stay true to, the script and get everything that's in the script somehow onto film, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then obviously, you know, adding the effects and the edit and such, you know?
Yeah. You know, something that in sci-fi, fantasy, even creature feature horror, that is an interesting challenge. I'm curious on your experience is how do you balance when you have a lot of effects heavy, you know, genre, how do you balance creative vision with practical limitations, because there is a balance there. How do you do that?
Well, you hire really good people.
Yeah.
But you know, like you want to try to shoot everything practical and then enhance it with the effects. You know what I mean?
I agree completely. Yeah.
So like even the trailer for Catskill Park, when you know, the cop guy, the state park ranger, it's like, did you guys hear that? And he gets wiped out by the creature.
Okay.
Right. Like, yeah. I tackled him on set.
Oh, really? That's great. And,
you know, so the effects guys just like put me in orange tape and stuff, you know, so they could track it.
Yeah.
And then his name is Conan, actually. And I just decked him like 9 times, yeah. and that movie was crazy because talk about having to like think on your feet. We were up in New Hampshire for that film, Day two, it snowed 3 feet.
Oh, man.
It was a Halloween blizzard, right? There's no snow in the script.
Oh, man.
So day one, when they're like trekking into the woods to go camping, like I wrote it into the script for them to talk about, it's not going to snow. How could it snow? You know, to set it up.
Oh, so then later
on day two, when they're around the campfire, it just timed perfectly.
Wow. You got lucky as you were shooting linearly then.
For the very beginning, yeah.
Yeah.
The very beginning, yes. But like, you know, it's crazy. But it was great because we had like a couple of condors and such, right?
Yeah.
To light up like the big fields for the UFO and such.
Yeah.
And because of this, we only rented them for like 2 days. But because of the snow, they couldn't come get them. So we had them the whole shoot.
That's great.
I'm like, this is gold, man. You know? This is amazing.
Oh, that's phenomenal.
Like $40,000, guys. Like, let's go. Bring that, you know?
Oh, man, that's great. I love it when unplanned things work to your benefit. That's incredible.
Yeah, totally, man.
You know, do you feel... I was thinking about the way that graphics are going to change as AI becomes much more impactful. Every day they're releasing new capabilities. And I'm curious, how do you think the industry changes in the next 5 years because of AI's capabilities?
We were talking about this the other day. Excuse me. I think in the beginning, which is now, AI is a really good tool to set projects up. So, for example, we're working on this big historical TV series. And we're talking about doing a trailer using AI in order to set up the series.
Yes.
Series costs a lot of money.
Yes.
You know, it's like medieval Italy. It's like the Joan of Arc of Italy. It's called Matilda. It's a real person who lived, you know. But it's a giant scope, you know. Yep. And it's like, in order to sell people on it and show them the vision, AI would be a very cheap way to do that.
Yes.
Now, do I want AI to like generate horses and, you know, do it in some kind of computer land? No. I don't, you know?
Right.
But in order to actually pitch the project, it's a good tool.
Yeah.
A lot of AI stuff I've seen, you could tell it's AI. You know, it's like...
Right. Yeah, it's not quite there, but if you extrapolate the rate of improvement, it will get to be undiscernible between... AI and actual pretty quickly. But I love that you're doing it like that. I had a personal project just maybe 6 months ago where I did the same thing. I did a trailer for a movie, an animated movie. And I used AI to transition my voice to various characters' voices.
Oh, that's cool.
I recorded my voice saying the lines. And then I changed one to a woman, one to an old man, changed it all. Right. I edited this trailer and then I used AI to generate some animated stills. And then I made just to pitch the overall concept, you know, if this is what we would want to do. So
yeah, like you used it as a tool.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
And that's what I think people are really scared of. And I say, no, I said, it's going to maybe rough in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But there is going to come a point where it's going to be the time of the storyteller. The storyteller cannot be faked. And that kind of visionary is going to be the hero at some point because of AI, because you've got that one person that doesn't have the tools to do, you know, to pitch their show. And now they can, exactly, you know, so I think it's going to work out.
I think so too. I mean, but you know, a good example. I'm doing the final edits on this book I have coming out, you know, and this guy Vic, who's interested in investing in the sequel to the Dementia 13 movie, he has like this genius Wall Street kind of guy. He's like, just send me the PDF and, you know, I'll run it through AI and it'll find all the mistakes. And I'm like, this is not going to work because the way it's written is not it's not conventionally written. Like,
right.
You know, it's like running Clockwork Orange, the book, right, through AI. AI would be like, none of this makes sense.
Right.
You know?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. You're
at some point, like, you need human eyeballs and the human brain to make sure it's right, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The you know, there is, AI is not going to come up with, you know, these kind of visionary filmmaker ideas like Oppenheimer or something like that. It's not going to be able to do that. So that will become more important. You know, I think for a lot of video production people who produce marketing videos, corporate videos, all of that work is going to be changed dramatically, because if you just need some stock footage that you used to license, but now you just need to prompt that. Yeah, that the stock footage business may be impacted. The commercial actor of nondescript, you know, selling pharmacy drugs, you know, that person, you know, that
you don't need them anymore.
Right. You don't need them anymore.
Pay them residuals anymore.
Right. Yeah. Right.
That
if you're trying to generate IP, you know, that you own, you're still going to have to produce that. That is going to be, So
like the short form stuff is, it's a blip.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think story becomes a lot more important as we go forward. Story becomes, you know, and I think, the selfie videos, you know, all that stuff, you know, that may become less important because it's going to be a commodity, easy to make, and, right, you know, all of that. So, I did have a question, we're kind of going into that area, but, you know, advice for aspiring filmmakers, you have some experience and, you know, I'm curious from your perspective, what are some common mistakes that first time filmmakers make when they're trying to produce their own short or their own feature? I'd love to get, you know, your experience.
Well, you know, I've always said it's a mixture of the creative, but it's also a business, you know? So you really need to learn the business if you want to make it in the business. It's funny because, you know, LA is very different than New York in that regard, right?
How so?
So in New York, you have, you know, these kids coming out of NYU and these film programs, $300,000 in debt, you know?
Right.
They're like, I want to be a director.
Yeah.
Like, go get me a coffee, you know?
Yeah.
And just stop talking and listen.
Yeah.
Because you need to learn the business. Whereas LA is more business oriented because it's the heart of the business, you know?
Right.
So I think the most common mistake is these delusional aspirations, and thinking that, like, oh, I went to NYU or I went to, you know, even UCLA or USC and I'm going to graduate and be Steven Spielberg. It's like, no, you're not. You're going to go work 100 hours a week for some monster of a boss who's stressed out of their mind, you know, for at least 2 to 5 years before you even get a chance to have a break.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, I know, you know, it's funny what you said, because I was asked to go be on a panel at TCU, a college here in Fort Worth University, on their film school. And I could tell by the questions that I was being asked that there was an assumption from the students that they were going to graduate and they were going to produce and direct day one. And so I told him, I said, listen, I think it's great you're getting this education. I think it's amazing. That's great. You're going to learn a lot. But when you leave here, you're qualified to be a production assistant, which means you're going to be getting somebody's you're going to be getting somebody's coffee. Yeah. And I go, and then you're going to meet people, and then you're going to be able to figure out which department you want to get mentored in. And then you can go in that department and get mentored. But day one, you're a coffee monkey. That's what you're doing. And that's to the reality of it. But you're right. I think that that's what I think a lot of people don't understand. A lot of kids don't understand when they first get to school.
And it costs a lot of money. I mean, right before the pandemic, we were putting together a program called Onset, which essentially...
Yes, that's it's a hands-on, affordable alternative, right, to traditional film programs. I read about that. Talk about that more. Yeah.
Now, the pandemic ruined this, by the way.
Oh,
we haven't got – we had horrible. Like – so the way the equation worked, we had 20 out of the 32 students we needed already. And a two-year program – they actually make a feature film that I then go sell with actual people who make real movies instead of making a short film.
Yeah.
And the kids, their tuition is treated as an investment in the movie.
Okay. Okay.
So if the $1 million movie makes $10 million, it pays for their, you know, they make money, you know, instead of being in student debt, you know.
Oh, that's great.
Something
that's
probably go back to down the line, but I'm just really focused on this book right now and the sequel to Dementia 13, you know?
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your book. You mentioned it, but I didn't get enough out of you on that. What is the book about?
The book's called Montauk Days, like D-A-Y-Z.
Okay.
And it's based on a true story. It's, you know... When I was 18, I drove to San Francisco from New York and got stuck there.
Okay.
And I ended up meeting Ken Kesey. You know, like Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Cooling Acid Test?
Yeah.
Ken Kesey, who wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That Ken Kesey.
Okay.
And the Merry Pranksters.
Wow.
So last night in San Francisco, I hung out with them. They did this play called Twister, A Ritual Reality at the Fillmore West.
Okay.
It's like a mind-altering, crazy experience, right?
Yeah.
So I flew back to New York and to my hometown out on Long Island. I'm like, I can't stay here, you know? So I grabbed my surfboard and I hitchhiked to Montauk. It's like a backpack, you know, flip-flops and my surfboard and $10, you know? So that's where it kicks off.
And it's, what year is this?
1994.
Okay. All right. I'm picturing it.
It's before cell phones.
Yes.
It's like the tail end of when you could almost not get killed hitchhiking, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Almost.
So, you know, the story spills out from there, but it's really just kind of a reflection on you know, it's a total batshit crazy adventure. Big waves, big chances taken in life kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
But also like a lot of reflection, spirituality, and just self-discovery, introspection, you know? It's cool. People are like loving it.
That's great.
But yeah, it's coming out June 19th.
June 19th. Okay. That's great.
This is the cover. I'm doing the final edit.
Wow. That's great, man.
Yeah. So the thing is that this manuscript, I started writing it when I was 20.
Yep.
Finished it in LA, lost it for 20 years. And then my sister asked me about the book. And I'm like, it's gone. And she's like, no, I have a hard copy of your book.
Oh my God.
I'm like, what? Like, if you're kidding with me, I'm going to kill you.
It's not cool. It's not cool.
No, Dan, I have a hard copy of your book, you know?
That's great.
Yeah. So and that was right before the pandemic, basically. So I just spent the pandemic trying to edit my 20-year-old self, which is a whole other story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Those. So, you know, it's funny. I wrote a screenplay mainly for therapeutic reasons that was about my personal experience after divorce kind of going down a spiral of, you know, depression and drinking and, you know, all of that and what that goes through, that, you know, it's not a unique story, but something personal for me.
Sure.
But I found it very, you know, fulfilling. I found it, you know, I felt great. And I was like, I really don't care if anybody ever makes this movie, but I felt great writing it. Do you have some kind of similar experience in that?
With this one, I've had that experience on different screenplays that I've written, you know?
Okay.
With this one, it was like editor hat.
Oh, okay. Okay. I gotcha.
Like a producer, you know,
yeah.
Like a creative producer. And I'm like, this has to go. This has, like, I cut 120 pages out of the original manuscript. I'm
okay,
like, what
wow.
was I thinking? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when you're 20 writing a book, it's like, what?
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I can't imagine.
Yeah, a little bit different, but at this point, and, you know, we have it out to like 150 people or so for like a pre-read.
Okay.
And that's since January. So everybody's finishing the book over the last couple of weeks. And like the response has been phenomenal. Like, I mean, these are half of them are strangers. I don't know them, you know?
Yeah.
And everyone's just, there's not one bad like review, which is crazy.
That's great.
Yeah.
It seems like a ideal for movie. To get option for a movie, because, you know, the 90s, that's the era, you know, the coming of age, late teens, early 20s and 90s, those folks our age now, you know, there hasn't really been an iconic 90s movie yet.
This would be it.
Right.
I'm not just saying that, but that's like part of, I'd say 90% of the feedback coming back is exactly what you just said.
Yeah. Yeah,
which is cool. Actually, we're already in talks with a company that wants to make it into a movie, but I'm like, let's wait until the book comes out.
You have more leverage then, for sure.
Well, it's not even leverage. It's just like we're working on pushing the book out. So there's time to, the movie's not happening tomorrow. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, thanks. Before we go, this has been great. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I want to do a quick fire Q&A, something a little fun, see how this goes. So lightning round, you know, have a little fun. All right. What's your all-time favorite science fiction movie or TV show?
Star Wars Empire Strikes Back.
Beautiful. That was the correct answer. No. okay. Who is a filmmaker or producer in the sci-fi fantasy world that you really admire or who has influenced you?
I would have to say Lucas. You know, I'm come from that Star Wars kind of base.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I love Kubrick. You know, I mean, his stuff is great.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. I just did a show yesterday about A Clockwork Orange. We talked about that. It was a great conversation. What a
brilliant movie.
Like character.
That's one, if it comes on the TV, even with commercials, you gotta just not go to work that day.
Yeah. Yeah. If you could visit any fictional world or universe from a movie, which one would you pick?
The cantina in Mos Eisley, which I recreated for a commercial we did for Samantha Bee. Iconic. So when her show was coming out, we produced a promo, right?
Okay, yeah.
So Samantha Bee walks in to the cantina from Star Wars, like a fumbling Jedi.
Oh my God. How did I miss that? I've got to find that on the internet.
Oh, it's awesome. That was a great day few days on set. It was like a bazillion-dollar commercial, right?
Yeah.
And so my day at the office was literally walking around all the characters from the cantina that we like had all made up, like guys who were like 10 feet tall.
That's incredible.
Little people, you know? And that commercial played in front of, I want to say it was maybe Phantom Menace, maybe.
Oh, but man.
So like they played it in the movie theater before that next Star Wars movie, yeah, to fake people out thinking it would be the opening to the Star Wars movie.
Oh, that's great.
So cool.
That is great. I have to find that. I love the show. She's hilarious. So I have to check that out. Well, before we wrap up, is there anything, you know, you'd like to direct people to, any kind of website or social media or anything you want to tell people about that they should go check out?
Yeah, well, everybody should check out the book because the book's coming out.
Montauk Hayes.
Montauk Days.
Days. I'm sorry.
So on Instagram, it's Montauk, MONTAUK _ DAYZ.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah. All right. Great.
From there, you know, you could look at Pipeline Entertainment and all that other stuff. It's kind of a good place to start.
All right. Well, thank you for doing the show, Dan. I wish you the best. And we will stay in contact with you so we can learn how the book does and all your future projects.
Sounds good. And I kind of want to see that cartoon thing. Email it to me.
Okay, I will.
I'll check it out.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Dad.
Thanks so much. I'll talk soon.
Okay.